Okay, let's move into the topic of security. This will be two parts to this topic. Firstly, is security in general, and then security as it can be manipulated and used in Java programs. So this first part is just generally about security. And some of the things you will have come across before, if you've done a network administration course or unit, then you'll have seen some of this stuff before. What you're trying to look at is you're trying to look at these issues of blocking unauthorized access, making sure that information doesn't get disclosed that shouldn't be, make sure that people don't change information, such as people's salaries and so on, and one that's specifically a networking thing is a denial of service type mechanism, where you stop people accessing things by just blocking up the service. So in general, security is going to affect every program that you write, but in particular, it's going to affect distributed programs, because when stuff is appearing on the network, much more chances of all of these things occurring. The earliest document that talked about security in any sort of compulsory sense was a thing called the Orange Book. This was invented by the US military, and what they were trying to describe was different types of systems and what kind of security they would need for the different types of systems. And what they were trying to say is that some things, well, forget it, no security at all. But if you've got something that's really top secret, then you move up this security level until you get something that matches the right level of security. The level D, you can get rid of straight away, because basically level D, minimal, says no security at all. And this is typically the case with operating systems like CPM, MS-DOS, a lot of the early PC operating systems, where anybody could walk up to any computer, you didn't need to log in, didn't need passwords, you could get to any file, you could change any file, no security at all. So that's the level D stuff. From there upwards, you're starting to put in more types of security mechanisms. So C1, separation of user and data, is where you're starting to talk about people logging into the computer, and depending on what their login is, they get access to a certain subset of the data that's there. So identification and authentication, who are you, and prove it by using some sort of password. Integrity-based means that you've got some mechanism for describing what it should be so that you can fall back to an ideal situation. And it's been tested in some way. C2 gets a little bit finer grained in the access control. So for example, the Unix type system where files are owned by people, they can put read, write, execute accesses on them. So you can control to a finer level what's going on in there. Also, formalized login mechanisms, auditing of security. So you have some mechanism for capturing events which are involved with security, such as a login history file, and somebody also is able to look at that history file and see what exactly went on. Okay. Most of the simpler systems are just level C1. Level C2 means that you've got to sort of toughen up the system a little bit. Level B1, the B levels move up a substantial grade. So even C1 and C2 are not really very secure. To get better level security, you've got to move up to the B levels. And within that, it moves into not just you've got the mechanisms there, but there's also a defined security model. And the security policy says what's allowed to be done, who's allowed to have access to things, what procedures have to be followed, and so on. In addition, the mechanism for describing files, so again, this is a US military thing, so they wanted to be able to describe files as top secret, classified, unclassified, a whole bunch of different labels on there. And enforced access control. So with say a system like Unix, you can even that kind of system, you can turn off all the security if you want to, but B1, you're not able to. Okay. B2 is when you're starting to move more into a mathematical descriptions of things. So a formal security policy model is something that can be analyzed mathematically and tested. Message authentication codes allow you to put checksums on all files so that you can see whether they've been tampered with. A checksum basically is a number you attach to a file, and if any change is made to the file, the checksum changes. So even if a single byte changes, then the checksum will be something different. So these allow you to keep track of whether any changes have been made to things. Covert channel control has things like, simple little things like not allowing anybody to plug a modem into a PC. As soon as you plug a modem into a PC, you've lost all your network security because people can just dial in and out and get anywhere. And much more extensive testing. B3, moving up again, more details in there. There are hardly any systems that most of these B levels. There are no systems at the A level, which is where you come up with a formal mathematical specification of the operating system, the operating environment, and you're able to prove that your systems are secure. So in practice, what's happened with this is that a lot of systems are at C1. The so-called hardened systems are at C2. So this is some Unixes, some versions of Microsoft, and very few are at the B1 level. Okay. There's also the OSI, the ISO. The ISO organization has also come up with a set of security issues. They've gone into it in much more detail than the Orange Book. What they've done is, firstly, they say, okay, we've got the 7-layer protocol stack. What are the security issues going to be at each one of those layers? And what can you do to make things secure at each of those layers? So the ISO security mechanism says, what kind of things do you want to protect? And which layers do they affect? And then how do you control this? So for example, the first one, peer entity authentication, that is, you've got two peers somewhere on the network, and one of them wants to prove their identity to the other person. So authentication is you're proving who you are to somebody else. And what layers that affects? Layers 3, 4, and 7. So 3 is the network layer. So this is where you've got a connection between two hosts, and you want to be able to prove who you are, which host you are, for example. The transport layer is where you're looking at things like the TCP mechanism. You need to be able to prove who you are at that layer too. The application is when, for example, if you're doing a telnet to a remote host, in order to prove who you are to the recipient of the telnet session, you log in, and that's peer authentication. So you're proving to one side who you are at that application level. These keep going all the way through. Data origin is where does it come from? And again, you need to be able to say it comes from a particular computer, it comes from a particular connection, and it also comes from a particular originating client application. Connection confidentiality, so skip to the fourth one. Connection confidentiality means that nobody in the middle can see what's going on. And in order to get confidentiality, you may need to look at techniques at almost all of the layers except for layer 5. Layer 5 is the one that does sessions. So that's just session management, keeping a session alive, so on. Every session is affected by the invisibility of what's going on all the way through 1 to 7, except for 5. And so it goes on down. Selective field confidentiality is if you're sending some data, some structured data around the place, and with that structured data, you want to be able to hide individual fields, and this takes place at the top two layers. Traffic flow confidentiality is if you don't want anybody to know which route messages are taking, then you want to hide the route that things are traveling on, okay. And so on. Down to things like non-repudiation at origin, non-repudiation of receipt. These are statements that you can't deny that you've sent a message, you can't deny that you've received a message. So this is, firstly, for non-repudiation at origin, means you can't say, I lent you $5 yesterday, and then today, no, I didn't lend you $5 at all. So you can't deny something that you've sent. Non-repudiation of receipt, something's arrived, and you can't deny that it has arrived at that end. And these are mainly application level ones. Okay, so there's a whole bunch of different things and which layers of the stack they operate at. And then in addition, there's the mechanisms which are used to give all of those features. So that, for example, peer entity authentication, if you're trying to prove who you are, one mechanism for doing that is to encrypt the data using some sort of key. And if you're the only person who has that key, then that acts as a proof of who you are. If you can encrypt it, you're the only one with that key, then it must be you. Okay. Digital signatures are an alternative way of doing this, where you sign a document in some way that the signature is uniquely associated with you, so it proves who you are again. Authentication exchange is something like when you often see this in internet, in phone banking and so on. You phone up, you say who you are, and then they say, well, what's the name of your grandmother? So you go through some backwards and forwards exchange where you give information that only you know, and the other side can then use that to verify who you are. Okay. Data origin authentication, again, if it comes from a machine which has an encryption key, then that's good enough, or if the machine signs it in some way. Access control mechanisms. Access control means you're trying to get to some sort of data, maybe a file, and what are the mechanisms used to give you access to that file? Some of this, well, things like passwords, pretty obvious. To get access to your files on the computer, you need to use your password for it. But there are also things which appear in the operating systems textbooks of access control lists and capabilities lists. Access control list is basically a list that's maintained by the resource which says who is allowed to have access to it. So just like logging in order to log in, then the system administrator has to have your name on a list of people who are allowed to log in. So the list of who's allowed to get to it. Capabilities lists go a little bit the other way, where you've got some sort of a token. If you prove that you've got the token, then you're allowed to get access to the resource. Labels, not quite sure about them. Okay. Confidentiality, this is to try and stop people seeing what's going on. You use encryption, and you can also sometimes use routing control. If you can control which route messages go travel by, then you have some control over who can see them. So if you don't want somebody on this machine to see it, you just route it around that machine. Okay. So connection-oriented confidentiality, connectionless, same thing. Selective fields, just a little bit of the data, you can encrypt that. Traffic flow confidentiality, if you don't want anybody to even know which route things are going on, or if you don't want to know that they sent messages at all, then you want to hide the traffic flow. And these are things, again, encryption can help. Traffic padding, things like traffic padding is, if you don't want somebody to know you're sending a message, one way of doing it is to just send messages every 5 seconds or so. So if you keep sending empty messages all the time, then nobody's going to know when one of those messages has got some content in it. So traffic padding, and you can send them off in lots of different routes. So broadcast something out every 5 seconds to 20 machines. Nobody can know what you're actually doing. Recovery involves the same techniques, but now you have some sort of data checking on it so that you can recover things and so on. What have we got? Non-repudiation at origin, non-repudiation of receipt, usually done by things like digital signatures. If you sign something and somebody keeps a copy of that signature, then you can't deny that you signed it afterwards. Notarization is a mechanism whereby you're not just talking between two parties, but you have a third party, a notary, and when you send the message across from one to another, you also get it checked by the notary so that this third party keeps a record of what's gone on. And if the third party keeps a record of things, then you can't deny that you received it or sent it. Okay, so what it means is that, going back up, what you'd look at is which kind of thing are you after? Are you after authentication? Are you after non-repudiation? Depending on which one of those that you choose, then you'd need to look at which layers of the protocol stack are affected. So non-repudiation at origin, you just need to look at the application. You don't need to worry about what the TCP connection's doing. You just look at the application level. And in order to do non-repudiation at the origin, you then look through how do we manage that non-repudiation. Three choices, the easiest one may be digital signatures. So if you want to make sure you can't do non-repudiation, your client in an application, the client side of your application, would sign a document before it sends it across. And similarly, the server side would sign it before it sends it across. Okay. There are general security policies which are used by system administrators. And there's one that is useful for the admin people, and there's one which tends to be preferred by users. And the one that the admin people like is, unless we said you can do it, well, you're not allowed to. Okay. So under this kind of policy, if you're allowed to do surfing to HTTP sites, then that's okay. But if there's a new protocol, a new chat protocol, a new file sharing protocol that comes up, if you're not explicitly allowed to access that protocol, then you're not allowed to. Okay. So under this kind of policy, you'd say something like, if the organization has said nothing at all about Napster, then you can't use it because it would be denied because it's not allowed. The other way is, so what users tend to prefer, unless it's explicitly prohibited already, then you can do it. So if it says nothing about Napster, then you could access Napster and so on. These need to be set at the organization level. And the problem is, if you're writing the programs, you don't have control over those policies, you just have to live with those policies. So for example, if the policy says no UDP traffic, then that's tough, you just can't use UDP. So you have to just live with those. It's better if it's really detailed. The more detail there is in the policy, then the better it is for you, because you can see what you're allowed to do, what you're not allowed to do. The functions needed, these are similar to what we're talking about before. Identification. Identification is the claim of who you are. So you say, my ID number is this, my username is this, whatever. You're claiming to be a particular person. Authentication is then the proof that you are that person. So when you log in, normally you claim who you are by giving your ID, and then you prove who you are by giving your password. integrity, data's not tampered with, so that no third party is changing things. Confidentiality, no one can see things. Delegation and administration does sometimes affect these things. This is the kind of thing that if your boss has access to some particular files and then he goes on leave, he needs to delegate his authority to you while he's away. Okay. Recording, monitoring, recording all security type accesses, recording logins, monitoring, just keeping a check on what's going on all the time. Okay. Anybody who uses any software, particularly from some companies, will be aware that any software has got bugs. And typically, the more complicated, the more bugs there are in it. You see this with even with things like a lot of the security software. Every now and again, there's a break into a security company because a lot of the time, security software is too complicated. So the simpler things are, the more chance there are that it's correct. The harder, well, it's bound to have bugs. Okay. Where you're looking at placing security is in host computers and in the network itself. So how do you protect host computers? You protect them by authentication and you protect them by authorization. So these are two different things. Authentication is who you are. Authorization is once you've proved who you are, what can you do? So once you've proved who you are, you can then have access to your files. Okay. Physical access. One of the extreme cases of physical access was at MIT, the top university in Boston. MIT has got some extremely bright students, and what they were trying to do was to make sure that their computer system could not be cracked by any of the students there. So they invented a system called Kerberos, and part of that system involved what they called a key server. If you got access to the key server, you had access to everything. So they had to protect that key server. And not only did they put strong network protections in it, they put it in a room, locked the door, threw the key away, so that nobody could physically get to that computer to do anything to it. Okay. And in extreme cases, that's what you do. You lock it in a room, nobody can get to it, so nobody can do anything. For network security, one way to make sure that nobody from outside can break into your network is to have no outside connection. So if you just have a home network with no broadband connection, then nobody can get in. Otherwise, you have to protect it behind firewalls or protect it using proxies of some kind. So protecting it by a firewall or router or whatever, a router is just a general mechanism for connecting a local network to some broader network. A firewall is a router that not just allows you to get through, but also controls access through the router. And with a firewall, some of the packets are going to be discarded, some of them are going to be passed. And if you're writing program, if there is a firewall and you need to be able to do client-server applications through that firewall, you need to know what's allowed to go through and what isn't. Okay. Because that firewall controls everything. And there's usually some sort of filter rules which will say what's allowed to pass and what isn't. The typical kind of filter rules, these are available with every kind of firewall. You can look at packet information and you can look at what's in some of these packets. So if you're sending Ethernet packets, there's an Ethernet header. You can look at the header. You can also look a little bit at the data that's on there. So if it's carrying IP data, then there'll be the IP headers, which will say where it's come from, where it's going to, and also TCP data. And you can look inside the TCP data and find what port it's intended for and so on, and look at the data itself if you want. Most of the filters will look at the IP data or the IP header and the TCP headers or UDP headers. Not many of them will look into inside the data. That's starting to change a little bit. There's now a technique called deep packet inspection. And deep packet inspection is when you look as right into the packet to see what's in there to try and figure out what it is. Okay. So if you're just looking at IP header, then what's in there is the source address, destination address, whether it's TCP or UDP, and then the packet body itself. And how this would get used by a filter, by a firewall filter, is, for example, if you want to block outward access, so if you want to let things come in but not to go out, then you just put a filter that discards all packets with a destination that's external. So if somebody's trying to send something outside, external destination, you can drop all of those ones. Conversely, you can block packets coming in by seeing if the source destination is external. It's a bit harder to filter on packet data because of IP segmentation. If you want to also look inside the TCP layer, then with TCP, you've also got the port number is part of the TCP packet. And within the TCP packet, you've got the source port. What port did it come from? What port is it going to? And for TCP, you've also got this thing called an ACK bit, acknowledge bit, and then plus the data. Okay. The ACK bit, we'll talk about it in a minute. Okay, we'll talk about it right now. Okay. What happens with the ACK bit is TCP is a session-oriented protocol. So once you set up a TCP session, you can continue to send messages backwards and forwards. That means you have a start to the session, and from then on, everything continues the session. Okay. And how you tell whether you're at the beginning of the session is by looking at the ACK bit. So the very first packet to establish a connection has that acknowledge bit set to 0. From then on, once the connection's established, that bit is set to 1. Okay. So this means that you can control the direction of a TCP connection. If you want to block somebody from outside initiating a connection, so you want to stop somebody from outside starting a connection to a server, then you look at the external IP source, means they're coming from outside. The ACK bit unset means they're trying to start the connection. So they're trying to start from outside, and then you can block it on that. If you do block that initial packet, then there is no connection, so everything else gets thrown away. Okay. Why you need to look at that ACK bit is because you might want to allow people from inside to start a connection to outside. So if you want to allow somebody from inside to telnet to a remote machine, or HTTP to a remote machine, they will be initiating it, so the ACK bit 0 goes out, and then once that connection is established, everything that comes back in has got the ACK bit as 1. So it allows you to go out, but if somebody from outside is trying to talk to your HTTP server, then when they try to establish the connection, their ACK bit is 0. So you can tell if a 0 is coming in, they're starting it. UDP is not so good, because it doesn't have a session. So there's no session start, session continue. Just has the source port, just has the destination port. So filtering on UDP is a lot harder because there is no concept of session there. For this reason, network administrators don't like UDP as much as TCP. So it's more likely that a UDP connection will be blocked because you can't figure out which direction it's coming. Okay. And for this course, well, for this type of subject, what it means is if you want to set up a UDP connection, then there is more likelihood that it will just fail than if you're setting up a TCP connection. Okay. an example of where things used to work nicely once upon a time, but don't so much anymore, is things like remote procedure calls. And this is, in particular, SANS RPC mechanism. What happens with remote procedure calls is it's like the client server situation, except the client is making procedure calls onto the server. Because there can be lots of procedure servers running, they all start off on a random port. So they don't all start on the same port. If they did, you could only have one server running. So to allow lots of possible RPC servers, they start off on a random one. How you find them if they start on a random one is that they all register themselves with Port Mapper. So every time an RPC server starts, it locates the Port Mapper on its own machine, port 111, says, I'm a new RPC server. Any calls that come in, send them off to me. Okay. So a client that wants to talk to an RPC server firstly makes a connection to Port Mapper, finds out what the real port is for the service, and then talks directly to that port. Okay. Problem with that is, although you might have this one open, network administrators hate this bit. Because if you can allow all ports to be open, people can start up random servers, and security is a lot weakened by that. So RPC used to work really well before security became a problem, and now it works really badly because people don't allow it through the random ports. There are techniques to get around it, and that's basically a cheat, but it seems to work a lot of the time. And we'll probably talk about that later. Okay. There's also the possibility of spoofing packets. People, when they're preparing a TCP packet, although they might put the source address in there, there's no guarantee that that source address is the real one. So they could put any address in there. And it's like emails. You've often got emails from people who don't exist or didn't really send it to you. Same with TCP packets. So if you're worried about where things come from, then you do a reverse lookup. You're told where it comes from. You go back to that host and see if it really exists and has the right IP addresses. And it's easier to spoof UDP than TCP. Another reason for why that might be blocked. Proxies, in addition to acting like firewalls in that they can filter, also have the property that they can do local answers. So the typical use for a proxy is to store things that people access regularly so you don't have to go out to the network. So what it means is for client-server is there's a whole bunch of sort of checklists that you should be doing. Verify origin, use login, care with configurable files, and so on. And we'll go through these one by one. So using logging, this is basically you maintain a record of every transaction that takes place. So every time someone connects to your server, you add a little entry in a log file. Every time somebody asks for something from your server, make an entry in the log file. That means that afterwards, if there is a security breach, then at least at one stage there was a log file there that people could look through. If people are trying to break into your system, if they succeed in breaking in, the first thing they try and do is to clean up the log file so their breaking doesn't show. So, but at least by keeping one, you provide a bit of a trail for things. Not only do you need to keep a log, but you also need to look at it every now and again. And this is how you find out that people are trying to break in, by looking at things that didn't work properly. The IP verification, from the IP packet, has got the origin, so you can find the IP name by doing a name server lookup. Using that name server lookup, you can find the actual address, and do a check to make sure that it really did come from that. And that helps reduce the spoofing possibilities. User configurable files. These are some programs allowed users to set up short circuits for security. There's a protocol called remote login, rlogin. And what rlogin would do, rlogin was very much like telnet. So you'd rlogin host, and then it would ask you, what's your username, what's your password? Okay, so just like telnet. If you're regularly logging into a particular computer, you get a bit fed up with that. Say, I'm always logging into this, so I don't want to have to put my username and password every time. So what rlogin had was, on the server side, it had a file called .rhosts, and you could put usernames in that file. Every time somebody logged in, so I'm logging in as Jan to this machine, it would check if the name Jan is in the rhost file. Well, it just logs me in. Doesn't bother to ask for a username or password. And that made it nice and easy, as long as it was me logging in. But then I discovered there was somebody at a different university who also had a user ID of Jan, and they were able to log straight into that account without any username or password. So if you allow holes to come up, then people will take advantage of them, or can do. Okay. Things like passwords. If you send them across the network in plain text, then packet sniffers can see them. And again, rlogin, this one that's not used so much anymore, rlogin just used to send passwords in plain text. Anyone could see them. Telnet, if anyone uses Telnet, you should stop. Because Telnet, all that Telnet does is runs them through an operation called UU encode. And what that does is it just changes some of the 8-bit data into 7-bit data. It's just a transformation to do that. But it is not encrypted. It looks as though it's strange characters, but it's not encrypted data. Anyone can UU decode it. You just run the UU decode program. So if you're sending Telnet connections, then your password is appearing in the clear on the network for anybody to look at it. Okay. It's not accepting, great. It's not enough to just encrypt the password itself. So having a sort of clear text mechanism with an encrypted password, somebody could see that encrypted password going across the network, copy it, and then the time they want to log in, they just use that copy of things. Okay. Are people talking about a lot of the human methods of identifying yourself? You know, why don't you use a thumbprint to log into your computer? Just stick your thumb on a pad, it'll read your thumbprint, and that's fine. Well, that's okay, unless somebody takes a copy of your thumbprint. If they do, then they just need to put the copy on that. Voice-activated systems, you speak into a microphone and say some secret code. Well, if somebody records it, then they just play that secret code into it. Right. And there's a few gruesome movies around with eyeball identification where they sort of cut the eye out. And that's one of the Dan Brown books, isn't it? Yeah. So anything that you can copy, you don't use that either. People who get really freaked out about these things use things called one-shot passwords. And a one-shot password, quite a lot of people use this when they're going away from somewhere for a month or so, going on holiday and want to log in. One-shot password, you create a list of passwords on the computer that you want to log into. You take a copy of that list. And then when you want to log in, you use the first one and it checks against the first one. So you log in with the first password on your list, then that doesn't work anymore. So next time you log in with the second one, and the next time you log in with the third one and the fourth one. And all the earlier ones don't work anymore, and the later ones, no one can guess them anyway. That's fine until you run out of passwords, and then you've got nothing you can do about it. You can't log in. Okay, how are we going for time? Let's take a break for a few minutes now.